yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, as promised last week, the topic this week is, of course, political. It's the recent midterm elections. We're going to provide our analysis of that and where things may be going as a consequence of the outcomes. Well, last week, if you recall, we talked about a broader picture. What did the U.S. look like on the eve of the midterm elections? And we sort of concluded it looked like it was unraveling on a number of fronts. Mass killings going on. Another one in California this morning. Over 350 of them so far this year. Mass killings meaning multiple people. 274 school shootings so far this year, 33,000 gun deaths, 45,000 suicides, 50,000 opioid deaths, and a great distraction going on. Instead of focusing politicians on these real issues, income inequality, never-ending wars, technology beginning to look like a problem rather than, you know, a positive force, an increasingly coarse culture, and democracy, institutions, and practices clearly being undermined, voter suppression, civil liberties, money in politics. What's the estimate? Over $5 billion spent, and that's just the tip of the iceberg in the elections, midterms, the most ever. $5 billion plus, that's not counting personal PACs, political action committees, and so forth, right? We don't even know that. And, of course, mass shootings and violence. Okay, so we got a kind of decadence going on in the society and the culture. And that's pretty clear, and that's been creeping up on us for at least a quarter century now. All right, that was the bigger picture. So what's the election look like? Let's go and talk about the election itself. What kind of an analysis can we provide about the election? Well, here's my analysis. It's no great revelation that the, quote, blue wave did not come on shore. What happened on November 6th barely got Trump his feet wet. Yes, okay, so they won the House. The Democrats won the House. But, you know, in these off elections, the out party always sweeps back in the House. And this is interesting. The average shift in the number of House seats in off-year elections is about 30. And it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to get 30, or if they do, barely get 30. So this is just a normal shift. Certainly not a blue wave. And look, you know, I'm not apologizing for Trump. If you've been listening to my shows and reading what I write, I'm definitely in the anti-Trump camp. But we got to look at this thing realistically and ask ourselves, you know, all this hype and this strategy, and we'll talk about the Democratic Party strategy, the suburbia strategy, hasn't produced results. And then why are they pursuing a suburbia strategy? What do we mean by suburbia strategy? Well, the suburbia strategy is targeting in marginal suburban districts, particularly independents, and college-educated women. That's what the suburbia strategy is of the Democratic Party in this midterm election. Go after these suburban districts and go after Trump, make it a referendum on Trump and his approach and his style and his racism and his statements and his policies, particularly his style and his statements, and swing the educated women vote in these marginal districts. If you look at what the Democrats did, they ran mostly women. And it's mostly women who won for them and gained these 30, perhaps, seats. There's some that still aren't being resolved, and we'll see, but certainly no more than, not much more than 30, and maybe not even that. I think there's something like a dozen or so still seats that still aren't finalized here, the vote finalized, and some governorships, and so we'll talk about those as well. The suburbia strategy of the Democratic Party is to target that group, independents and female voters, particularly college-educated female voters. Now, that got the Democrats a few seats here. Not a lot, but some. The question is, that strategy getting a normal shift, certainly not a wave, a normal shift, is that going to work in 2020? Targeting these marginal suburban districts, is that going to work? Is referendum on Trump really the centerpiece of a successful strategy in 2020? Well, Nancy Pelosi believes so. You know, she came out right after the election as the spokesperson for the Democrats and declared that they had just won a great victory. But was it great or even a victory? Well, you may want to read my deeper analysis here on my blog, jackrasmus.com, an article which I call None Dare Call It Victory, Part 1, Part 2 to follow. All right, so targeting the suburbia, a couple dozen or so toss-up House districts in an off-year election has been the strategy. And we got to ask ourselves, is that an effective strategy going forward? No, and of course, the liberal press jumps in and says it was a victory as well. MSNBC and the anti-Trump CNN, they all said yes, right? Even center-left periodicals like The Nation magazine, really a mouthpiece for the Democrats, right, on the left, declared, big headlines, we won. And Washington Post editorials declared it a path to victory in 2020. Okay, so will it stop Trump? Well, it certainly did not stop Trump this time around. That was promised, right? In fact, as we'll talk about it, in some ways, Trump is even in a stronger position than he was. How do we explain that? Well, we'll get to that one, right? All right, so winning 30 seats is no historic victory. It's just a normal shift. Trump isn't going to lose any sleep over that. He's going to stay up late tweeting now, as he already has begun, really puffing up the fact that the Republicans, the Trump-publicans, clearly won a victory in the Senate. You know, in these off elections, the Senate usually swings by four votes, four seats. And the Democrats should have won four seats in the Senate. Well, they lost four seats in the Senate. It was a debacle in the Senate for them. They may have won 30 seats in the House, but they lost even more in the Senate. Now, that's strategic. Let me explain why. But first, what are going to be the consequences of having lost four seats in the Senate? Four more seats, right? They were already in a minority in the Senate, a bare minority, 51, 40, 48, 49. And, you know, now it's 54, pretty clear, 54. They held on to some Senate seats in Montana and other places, and they, you know, won a few here in Nevada and so forth, but they lost some big seats, important seats, in the heartland of Red State America, in Missouri and in North Dakota, and it looks like they're going to lose the seat in Florida and a couple others. So what the picture is the Democrats, where they had seats, they lost, but the Republicans held on to their seats and won even more. Now, what that's going to mean, think about it strategically. What is that going to mean going forward? The fact that the Senate is now firmly in the hands of the Trumps. And by the way, the Trump Republican Party is beginning to look more and more like Trump, isn't it? You know, he's purposely driving out those who disagree with him, the moderates in the Republican Party. He talks, insults them, and talks down on them and so forth, those who are already in Congress, in the party in Congress. And he drives them out, you know, the Jeff Flakes and there's that guy in Tennessee there, Corker, I think his name is, and others, drives them away purposely. And if you watch what he did during this election, he went out and he supported people who, you know, fawn on him and support him, his wing in the Republican Party, and he purposely insulted those who didn't want him to come around. So he's driving out opposition or those who just won't kneel down to him in the Republican Party. It's becoming a Trump-publicans. You know, let's not call them Republicans. Let's call them Trump-publicans, because that's what they are more and more. He's shaping it in his image. And that'll be going on here throughout the next 2 years as well. That's dangerous. That's really dangerous. You know, it reminds me of Adolf Hitler. You know, I don't want to overdo the fascist thing, but, you know, Adolf Hitler in the very early years. Go read the early years of the Nazi Party. I'm talking about 1919 to 1923, where Hitler was forging coalitions and creating the Nazi Party, National Socialist Deutsche German Workers' Party, which what it was called. You know, always appealed to workers. You see, National Socialist Workers' Party. That's the Nazi Party. And he made that party in his own image, and he became, quote, the leader. The whole leader principle is something that Hitler created for himself. And his followers, you know, adored him. He could do no wrong. Sound familiar? He could do no wrong. Doesn't matter what he did and said, and his, you know, what his statements got more and more insulting and threatening and violent, targeting existing politicians, both within the right-wing movement and, of course, in the government, which was not right-wing, the Weimar government. Some real eerie things going on here, very, very early. But we need to keep a watch on that. Okay, so Trump is even in a stronger position now with the Senate. Any possibility of impeaching Trump, now forget it. And already you see the talking heads of the Democratic Party leadership coming online and being interviewed in talk shows and so forth, really talking down the impeachment thing. Oh, we can't do the impeachment thing because, it'll only be bad PR for us. It may backfire on us. You know, it backfired when the Republicans went after Bill Clinton, and it's going to backfire on us, too. We can't do it. and all this election, pre-election stuff about get Trump, not going to happen now. Why? Well, you know, if you look at the system, impeachment proceedings are brought up in the House. The House impeaches, but the Senate then has to conduct the trial. And even if the Senate did a trial, impeachment doesn't mean they remove him. You know, it's just a public slap on the wrist. So are the Democrats, if they know there's a 54 Trump majority now, solid majority, and Mitch McConnell, he does what, you know, he's Trump's puppy. He does whatever Trump wants now. They love each other, McConnell and Trump. There's not going to be any follow-up in the Senate. And the Democrat leadership is using this as a, you know, a talking point. It says, look, you know, it's futile to do anything in impeachment in the House because it'll never get through the Senate. Well, there's some truth to that, you know. All right, so the possibility of impeachment of Trump out of the question because of the 54 majority now, solid majority that the Republicans have in the Senate. Another thing that's going to happen is you're going to see a flood of conservative federal judge appointments now, a flood. It was already beginning, and McConnell was outmaneuvering the Democrats already, pushing through all these federal judgeships that he blocked during 8 years of Obama. It bottled it up. And now he's uncorking it, and the Republicans and Trump publicans are appointing all these second and third tier below the Supreme Court judgeships. And by the way, there probably will be another third Supreme Court appointment here by Trump before 2020. So Trump will have a, and if you notice, the people he's appointed are in their 50s at the oldest, right? They're going to be there for decades, decades. Which reminds me, you know, why didn't Obama, who could have appointed a Supreme Court, after Garland was rejected, well, not rejected, they didn't even allow Garland to come up for a vote. McConnell didn't, you know, during Obama's period. As I understand it, Obama, when Congress, the Senate was out, could have appointed somebody, could have appointed Garland, and that would have forced a vote when the Senate got back. But he didn't do it. He didn't do it. He could have, but he didn't. You know, Obama, I call him Mr. Jell-O. You know, he sort of stands in one place and he moves to the left, he moves to the right a little bit, but he never really moves anywhere. You know, that characterized the Obama presidency, and, you know, very, very timid kind of a presidency, especially when it came to dealing with Congress. Okay, so I don't want to talk about Obama. Let's get back. What are the consequences of this solid Senate win here that occurred this past week? Well, no impeachment. Just to recap here, a flood of district judgeships, right? And a likely third appointment here. I just heard that Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg is injured. She fell. You know, she's quite elderly. And, you know, when you're in your 80s, it's kind of hard to go to work every day. And if, you know, for medical reasons, she steps aside, well, then we're going to get another even more radical right appointee to the Supreme Court. I mean, look, you know, Trump could nominate Genghis Khan, and his in-his-pocket Senate would vote him up now. Okay, it also means Mitch McConnell, you know, as the leader of the Senate Republican majority, or Trump Republican majority, we should say, is now going to even more aggressively attack Social Security, Medicare, and education spending than he's already signaled he's going to do. You know, a few weeks ago, he signaled, that's what we got to do. You know, they love going after the you know, those areas, those programs. They've gutted most of everything else, but that's the biggie, you see, Social Security and Medicare. That's what they're going to go after. Why? Because they got a $1 trillion budget deficit every year for the next 10 years that they got to borrow money for. And interest rates are going up, so the cost of borrowing that money is going up. The Fed's raising rates and will continue to raise rates because it's got to raise $1 trillion plus every year. And even more if we have a recession, which we're going to have. You know, it could be $1.5 trillion a year. Why is it? Because of the Trump tax cuts and because of the defense spending increases, $100 billion a year. Yeah, it's $100 billion a year. It's not 85. It's $100 billion because there's this thing called the black budget that doesn't appear in print anywhere that funds the Pentagon and the military's new secret military technology projects. And Trump is even saying we're going to create a space force and they're going to spend more in cybersecurity and new weapon systems. Yes, that's going on, and that's going to raise the cost of $100 billion more a year. We're already spending $1 trillion a year when you look at it in all the departments, not just the Pentagon. That's only part of the war spending. You know, the military finances all its oil needs out of the Energy Department. And then the Atomic Energy Department handles the spending for a nuclear arms. And we're going to get a new round of nuclear weapons, he says. So the tax cuts, massive, $4 trillion, and the escalation of defense war spending is why we got a $1 trillion budget deficit every year, that the Federal Reserve has to borrow money to fill the hole by raising interest rates. And as it continues to raise interest rates into 2019, it's going to precipitate the next recession, and that's going to make the budget deficit even worse because 2/3 of the deficit is because of taxation, not spending, taxation. Okay, so Mitch McConnell now has a great opportunity to go after Social Security, Medicare, you know, especially SSI and prescription drugs and so forth. They're going to go at, by the way, prescription drugs passed in 2005, contributes over $50 billion a year to the deficit, maybe $60, $70 billion, I'm not sure. Why? Because when they passed the Part D prescription drugs plan, they provided no funding for it. It was all going to come out of deficits. Okay. So what we're going to get is a new, more aggressive attack on Social Security and Medicare and education. They always like to attack education spending. All right. What we're going to see as well is now the big tax handouts to businesses are baked in. There's no way that they're going to repeal that, the taxes, the $4 trillion. And, of course, what happened as soon as the results of the midterms were in and 54 votes in the Senate, you know, whoa, the stock market loved that. It went up 545 points, the Dow, in one day. Yeah, they knew. No chance it'd be repealed. They can count on that for another decade. Also, we're going to see a new attack on abortion rights and immigrants. You know, is there going to be a DACA deal for the House? I mean, for the wall? No. Immigrants, particularly Latinos, forget it. Nothing's forthcoming here now. All right. It's not just the Senate, by the way. It's not just the Senate that we might say indicates a loss. It's certainly not a blue wave. The red tide kept coming in. the blue wave did not come, but the red tide in the red states. You see, this picture is one in which the red state base of the Trumpublicans is being even more solidified. They're even stronger in these red state base. And around the fringes are the blue states and the Democrats. And they chipped away a little bit at the suburbia margins here and there, but the red state solidified. There's some evidence of some possible cracks in that red state bastion. We'll talk about that. But the picture is a further solidifying of Trumpublica in those red states. And you see it in also in the governorships, strategic governorships retained by the Republicans, the Trumpublicans. Which ones? Well, Georgia, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina. These are key states, swing states, that usually determines the electoral vote outcome in presidential elections. These states are firmly now, although there's a contest here going on in Georgia we'll talk about, appear to be firmly in the hands of the Trumpublicans. Now, why is that important? Not only that they're swing states, and whoever runs the governorship, you know, has a big impact on the outcome in the national presidential elections, but these are the states that are notorious for manipulating voting and election outcomes. It was Florida in 2000, remember that? That gave George W. Bush, even though he did not win the majority popular vote, gave him Florida, manipulating and voting voter suppression. You know, Florida has had a long-standing rule, just changed here, by the way. We'll see if it, you know, the initiative that people voted on in Florida was to give people who had felonies the right to vote. In Florida, if you engage in a felony, even though you went to jail and served your time and you came out, you had lost your citizen voting rights for life. Okay, so there was an initiative on the ballot in Florida that passed that said that now, unless you were a felony due to a killing or a child molestation, that you could not vote. All right, so how many people? 1.5 million people now just in Florida can hopefully vote, unless the court's challenged, and we're going to see that, block that initiative for the next 2 years. Don't let it come through, so that 1.5 million more people who tend to vote Democrat, you know, because most people go to jail or are people who don't have a lot of money. So, you know, in 2000, maybe 1 million people were denied the right to vote in Florida. That's voter suppression. Hey, that's been going on there a long time. You know, that's a vestige of Jim Crow. And a lot of places in the South, the same thing. All right, so Florida, Ohio, 2004. All right, same thing. Ohio has a long history of manipulating, through the direction of the governor, manipulating the vote, and you know, through Ohio does it more through electronic voting machines. You see, and there was a big question about that in 2004 when Kerry was running, but Kerry threw in the towel real quick. Didn't demand, even though there was evidence, a review of the vote, just like Gore threw in the towel in 2000. Well, people are making them throw in the towel. And, of course, you know, they have plans for subsequent careers. Kerry went on, of course, Secretary of State under Obama. So they throw in the towel. You know, the elites don't want to really fight in front of everybody. But Ohio has a long history, and Ohio and Florida are firmly in the camp now. And then North Carolina just passed a initiative here in the election. giving the legislature and the governor the right to suppress votes. Now, how do they suppress the votes? There's lots of ways. One of the favorite is going on in North Dakota. You have to have a street address, you see. If you don't have a street number, you don't have the right to vote. Or you got to have an ID card or some other difficult evidence. You got to have a driver's license. You know, not everybody drives. Not, you know, why do you need an ID card? Everyone's got some form of identification. Why does that have to be a special ID card? Why do you have to pay in order to vote in any way? Well, in North Dakota, they just eliminated 30,000 Native Americans from voting, although they tried to come back and reorganize it. But, you know, tens of thousands of Native Americans just in North Dakota were prohibited from voting up there. And, of course, that meant the end of the Democratic Senator Heitkamp. As a result, if the Native Americans were allowed to vote, she probably would still be in office. North Carolina, you know, and Arkansas as well have passed initiatives giving the governor the opportunity to restrict voting in these various ways. North Dakota. And so, in other words, the picture in red state America, except for the Florida case, which I predict will be blocked, is making it harder and harder for anybody who doesn't support Trump to vote, solidifying the base. The governorships are strategic, and where the Democrats have made some inroads, again, have been on the margins of red state America, not in its core. All right, so the picture is one of maybe a small wavelet in the House, blue wavelet, and a red tide that continues to roll in red state America, as evidenced by control of the Senate and these strategic governorships. What about in Georgia? You know, here's a good example of voter suppression. Over 100,000 voters, potential voters, were deprived of the right to vote in Georgia alone in this last election by the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, who was also the candidate of the Trump Republicans for governor. So, you know, picture this. Here's this guy, Secretary of State, comes up with these rules preventing people from vote on his own behalf as the candidate for the Republican candidate for governor. Okay, it's even then, it's very close. You know, the Democrat candidate, Abrams, she's demanded a vote recount. Good for her, you know. Don't throw in the towel like Gore and Kelly, Kerry. Don't throw in the towel. Challenge it. You know, if you go back to 2000, there were people in the Democratic Party that really wanted to challenge it. They wanted to go down and protest and demonstrate and so forth, and they wanted to do a count, a recount in Florida in all of the counties, you know, and Gore told them, don't go down and demonstrate, you know, let's rely on the Supreme Court. And we're only going to ask for a recount in a couple counties there in South Florida, not for the whole state. You know, what a wimp. And, of course, the Supreme Court then steps in and selected our president, George W. Bush, which it has no right to do. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives them the right to do that. But they did it. You know, I mean, look, there's nothing in the Constitution that says the Supreme Court should have the right to declare a law unconstitutional. No. Go look. Go read your Constitution. In fact, there's very little said about the court system in the Constitution. This was a kind of a judicial coup d'etat that occurred, you know, a decade or so later under Marbury versus Madison decision. The Supreme Court simply assumed it for themselves. And why did they do that? Well, because you had kind of a populist second revolution there under Jefferson in the 1800, right? So to check that populist revolution that sort of put the Federalist Party, the Republicans of the day, in check here, the Supreme Court assumed for itself that role. And ever since then, the Supreme Court is like the third, institution of government in the U.S. that checks and balances, right, other parts of the institutions of the government, the legislature. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have the Senate checks the House. The House is the real reflection of the people. In a parliamentary system, it's only the House. They don't have another bicameral second institution that has to pass through there and tends to be much more conservative, elected every 6 years. Well, at first, in the first century, they weren't even elected. They were appointed by state legislatures. We didn't have direct election of senators. And we still don't have direct election of the president. This whole electoral college thing is a farce. If you want real democracy, it should just be representatives of the people who are elected every 2 years, determined, and that's the will of the people. That's the people who are sovereign. If they're really sovereign, then that's all you need for democracy. You don't need a Senate, right? You don't need an electoral college. We have a very conservative form of democracy in this country. And then, of course, you have the backdrop of the Supreme Court, which is now firmly in the hands of the rich and the Republicans, the Trump-publicans, excuse me, firmly. If Trump is even thrown out, do you think that there can be any real structural change politically, democratically, politically here after 2020 with that Supreme Court? No. Mitch McConnell, during the Obama period, is responsible, and of course Obama, for being so damn timid, is responsible for this situation with the Supreme Court, this third institution of government that usurped its authority way back when. All right, moving on, right? Another consequence of the election is that Mueller's going to go. Mueller, the guy who's investigating, right? Now Trump is going to go after him. He's already fired Justice Department Secretary Jeff Sessions immediately, right after the election, fires this guy, puts in his yes man, as he's putting in yes men everywhere. You see, anyone disagrees with him, anyone who represents the traditional capitalist elite in this country is being driven out of his administration. He puts this Whitaker guy. I mean, God, we got Whitaker there. We got John Bolton, the National Security Advisor. We got Pompeo, Secretary of State. We got the generals running the rest of it. We got the shadow bankers running Treasury. My God, what a group. All right, so Mueller is now behind an eight ball, right? And next guy to go is Rod Rosenstein, who was sort of representing the FBI and Justice Department liaison here with Mueller. I predict he's going to go. He's going to resign or something. Trump had a meeting with Rosenstein a month or so ago, brought him into the White House, and they probably cut some kind of a deal because somebody leaked some stuff about Rosenstein and his early private statements to somebody about Trump being unstable. And that we should declare the 25th Amendment, I think it is, an unstable, psychologically unstable president. You could interpret the 25th Amendment to say that if the president's unstable, he can be removed. Well, you know, Rosenstein apparently said something like that a couple years ago. Well, that got leaked to the press, and it put him in a defensive position, and there was talk about Trump getting rid of him. But then he went to the White House, and now they're all buddy-buddy. Right? Rosenstein's in the Trump camp now. You know, and if he comes out somehow, or even if he doesn't, you know, he may be gotten rid of as well. We got a yes man Whitaker there, and we got Rosenstein, you know, out on a limb. And further out on that limb is Mueller. Now, technically, Mueller and his investigation could be brought under the wing of the House, the Democrat House. But that will make it look like it's a partisan kind of a thing going after Trump. And that will weaken his position. You combine that with the fact that there's no way there's going to be any impeachment proceedings of Trump. Look, what the Democrats are going to do is that they're going to huff and puff, have hearings, but it'll never get out of committee, you know, House committees, to really take on Trump and censure Trump. They're not going to do it. They're just going to try to do a PR thing on Trump, and nothing's really going to happen here. PR campaign from their perch in the House committee hearings. Right? Smoke and mirrors, offensive to stop Trump. And, you know, if you listen to Pelosi after the elections, it looks like now she and Trump have this big love fest. There may be a challenge to Pelosi here as Speaker of the House, but don't count on it being successful. Right? The Democratic leadership, the DNC, Democratic National Committee, you know, is firmly behind Pelosi. And who's got control of the DNC? Well, it's the corporate wing has control of the DNC. You know, this is the central committee of the Democratic Party, you know, makes the strategy decisions and so forth. Well, it's firmly in the hands of the money bags. You know, over 100 members of that committee are either corporate CEOs, managers, or lobbyists, you see. We shouldn't, you know, just as we should change the name of the Republicans to Trump-publicans, we should probably change the name of the Democrats to lobbycrats. You know, Trump-publicans and lobbycrats. Two wings of the corporate party of America, you know, who are engaging in a kind of internecine warfare between each other because they have different visions of what strategy, you know, for the capitalist class that they represent going forward in the next decade. Got to change that strategy, you see. Up to now, the strategy is called neoliberalism. You know, I'll be talking about that term here in my new book forthcoming early 2019 called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. Okay, we'll be talking about that subject as we get closer to the book's release, probably. But, you know, that's the strategy that's been in place since Ronald Reagan up to the 2008 crash. And that crash disrupted that strategy. And Obama couldn't put the pieces back together again. Well, Trump is putting it back together again in an even more virulent, aggressive 2.0, neoliberalism 2.0 form. That's what Trump policies are all about. And neoliberalism is really about domestic class warfare and a more aggressive set of policies targeting other global capitalist competitors. You know, there's a trade or external element to the neoliberalism, and the U.S. is Trump is reordering the rules of the international economic game. That's what this is all about with Trump policy. At the same time, it's reordering the domestic policy, industrial policy, wages and jobs and so forth. And you see that in the escalating inequality in the U.S. All these policies are designed to transfer income and wealth more from working folks to the very rich. And then internationally, the same thing, a bigger share for American capitalists and multinational corporations. That's what neoliberalism is. And it's coming out now in a more virulent and aggressive form, both domestically and internationally. Okay, so, you know, we're not going to see any impeachment here, and we're going to see a lot of huff and puff, the same old Democratic strategy, and even more so because now there's this emerging love fest between Pelosi and Trump. It's called bipartisanship, you see. Listen to Pelosi when she came out. Oh, well, all kind of signals to Trump. We want to be bipartisan. And Trump immediately tweets, hey, you know, Nancy's, I like Nancy. You know, I hope Nancy is the new House Speaker. We can work together. Big overtures, praising her publicly. And she praises him back. Well, you know, there's the two wings are signaling to each other. Well, let's get together here. You know, this is all politics. We are going after you, Donald. It's all politics, right? And we know you're an opportunist. And, you know, now that we're in the House, you'll work with us. What are they going to work on? You know, now they've got this love fest going. Well, what they're going to work on is infrastructure spending. Yeah, with a $1 trillion deficit, infrastructure spending. Well, the Democrats got to show they did something in the House, right? And there's this big fiction about infrastructure spending going to create a lot of jobs. Look, what Trump means by infrastructure spending is not what you think it means. Doesn't mean government spending on projects. What it means is more subsidies and tax cuts to commercial real estate developers. That's what he means by it. Of course, that's his family, isn't it? That's his source of wealth. Commercial real estate wheeling dealing. Commercial real estate is in a real funk right now, as is residential real estate, going nowhere and about to go south. Okay, so infrastructure spending, you know, really more tax cuts, hidden tax cuts and subsidies and so forth. Wheeling dealing. That's what they mean by let's work together. Also, there are going to be some phony joint moves on doing something about price gouging by big pharmaceutical companies, you know, which is out of control, totally out of control. So, you know, they'll do some smoke and mirrors together on that one if they do it. If Pelosi is the chair, which I suspect the next 2 weeks she will be anyway. Yeah. So maybe something on family leave, paid family leave. You know, the U.S. is the worst of the industrial nations in terms of family leave. Maybe some token tax cuts, you know, maybe 5%. This is less likely, but, you know, on middle-income, median families, right, the middle class, 5% tax cuts in exchange for making the $4 trillion investor business tax cuts earlier this year, permanent forever. Yeah, that'll be the trade-off there. So there are some areas where, you know, both sides, both wings can make it look to the public like they're doing something for the next 2 years. And that's probably where we'll be headed here. And, you know, this means that the Democratic Party strategy in power is bipartisanship, and when it's out of power, it's now this suburbia strategy. Its electoral strategy is suburbia strategy, and its a legislative strategy is bipartisanship. Now recall bipartisanship under Obama, right? Obama kept talking, oh, let's be bipartisan, kept extending its hand to McConnell and the Republicans, and the Republican dog bit it every time he extended it. And he just kept extending it and so forth, right? And the coalition that Obama had put together in 2008 was significant, but he dribbled it away. what was the coalition? It was youth and millennials, it was Latinos and blacks, and it was union workers. That was the coalition that worked for him big time. But bipartisanship wasted it. And we know very little was accomplished under Obama for the rest of us. You know, bail out the banks, yeah. Bail out the wealthy, yeah. Bail out businesses and corporations, yeah. You know, profits tripled, quadrupled, stock market tripled, quadrupled. $1 trillion a year in handouts and stock buybacks and dividend payouts every year under Obama, every year to the 1% and their corporations. And the rest of us, stagnant or declining wages. Yeah, that was the recovery. Yeah. And that was a result of bipartisanship. You know, what did he achieve? He achieved, some token financial regulations, which are now being quickly dismantled under Trump. Very temporary, right? And Obamacare. You know, some good things of Obamacare, you know, but those are being chipped away and dismantled quickly too. You know, what under Obamacare? Medicaid, you know, a positive thing, you know, millions of people added to Medicaid. Existing conditions, yes. 26-year-olds living with their family, many of them are. You know, those were all good things, but to get Obamacare, you had to bribe the insurance companies. And that's what Obamacare is. It's really a insurance company re-regulation act, you see, in which they bribe the insurance companies. Well, anyway, Obamacare is being chipped away step by step here since they couldn't repeal it outright. And McConnell's he's number one. Let's go after health care and Social Security and Medicare. His number one objective is to eliminate Medicaid, the Medicaid provisions of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. Okay, so the Obama strategy and coalition collapsed because of Obama bipartisanship. And that's why the Democrats had to come up with a new strategy, which is the suburbia strategy, you see. The Obama coalition and strategy dissipated as a result of do-nothing policies, timid policies. Maybe we call them timidcrats, huh? Lobbycrats, timidcrats, you know, either one works. Mm-hmm. And so the Democrats had to come up with something. So they come up with this marginal thing called suburbia strategy. But that suburbia strategy is a dead end, as bipartisanship is a dead end as well. What's going to happen with bipartisanship? This is what bipartisanship means. Think about it, right? The Democrats are going to come up with Trump, probably with some kind of weak, watered-down infrastructure spending bill or prescription drug price gouging limits bill or paid family leave bill. They're going to come up with something like that. And then it goes to the Senate. And it runs into the Mitch McConnell wall, right? And that big majority in the Senate who will be proposing stripping out spending for Medicare, Social Security, food stamps, housing, education, and so forth. So we got these two totally different legislative initiatives that are going forward. And if the Democrats want to get their watered-down infrastructure spending and prescription drug limit initiatives passed, they're going to have to agree with Mitch for changes and reductions in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and so forth. They're going to have to agree with it. It's going to have to be a trade-off. So they're going to agree to weaken these other programs to get these watered-down, weak programs passed to show that they're doing something. And in what's called the House-Senate Conference Committees, where just the leaders of both the Senate and the House, work out their differences and slash and cut this and that from their mutual positions and agree on a weaker compromise, that's where the Democrats are going to get whacked. And even their proposals for infrastructure and drugs and family and so forth are going to come out looking even weaker than they proposed. But they're going to be able to say, oh, look what we did. You know, in these areas, people are going to realize that it's really a lot of smoke and mirrors. And they won't say much factually true about the cuts in Social Security and Medicare at the same time. Well, this picture of bipartisanship and legislation is what we've seen already with the Democrats. It was, you know, the hallmark of Jimmy Carter's regime there after 1978, after the first 2 years, after 1978. It was the hallmark of Bill Clinton's second term, make all these concessions to business and Republicans and the right. And we saw it during Obama's first term. So this is a pattern, you see. This is a legislative pattern that goes on and on. Whenever the Democrats get in power and we see bipartisanship. Mm-hmm. You know, the other elements of the suburbia strategy of the Democrats here in the election were pump up this thing about the Russians, right, and go after Trump personally, his personality. Well, no one gives a damn about the Russians, you know, out there in the real world of America. You know, it just doesn't. There isn't enough evidence, hard evidence, and maybe there is, but they're not sharing it. And who cares about that, really? You know, the real threat to democracy are these state governors who are suppressing voter rights and so forth, and the money in politics. That's the threat to American democracy. It's not the Russians. Yeah, well, those two elements, attacking the Russians, attacking Trump's personality, go after his personality, it only improves his support in the red states. They love him no matter what, right? The more you attack him, the more they love him, right? Just like Adolf, right? And then we have these newcomers in the Democratic Party, Beto O'Rourke in Texas, Abrams in Georgia, Mullins in Florida, two blacks, Abrams and Mullins, who almost, despite the voter suppression in these states, almost pulled it off. They didn't get much support from the Democrats, and they're not getting it. Mullins and Abrams are not getting much support to challenge the votes in those states that were stolen from them, over 100,000 in each case, in which they would have won. And then Beto O'Rourke really lit a fire, you know, an old-fashioned Democrat on the stump talking about the real class-based issues, you know, incomes and so forth. People wanted to hear. A lot of Texans who wouldn't vote came out and voted for him. He almost won, and he probably might have won if the Democrats hadn't pulled money from him, the leadership of the Democrats, in the last 2 weeks. Yeah, they took money from Beto O'Rourke and they gave it to other candidates. Who knows? Maybe he would have prevailed. Anyway, you know, the O'Rourkes, the Abrams, and the Mullins, these are the type of candidates that the DNC leadership of corporate money bags and lobbyists don't really feel comfortable with. This is the old Democrats, you know, an old Democratic strategies. And, you know, they're sort of giving these guys lip service, but there'll be a fight within the Democratic Party over its soul in coming years, whether the O'Rourkes, Abrams, and Mullins, you know, are going to reassert and take over that party. Don't count on it. You know, the money bags and lobbyists are well entrenched in the DNC, and just as they've successfully sidelined and driven out Bernie Sanders supporters, they're not going to let supporters of O'Rourke and Mullins and so forth really take over that party either. So, you know, the Democrat strategy is the suburbia strategy. Go after the Russians, go after the personality of Trump. I don't think that's going to be successful in 2020. I don't think that's a formula for success. Okay, that's my take on the elections here. And we'll be talking about the policy and consequences economically in future shows here. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.